pause. People don't have to listen to me. No one came here for me.
Always lovely to have my dad in town. Oh, all right, fine. All right.
So I
could have come with him, save the toll.
Exactly right. You could have tried that one. So what was that? Yeah, you know, okay, fine. All right, good. So
two tolls, not a
I grew up in Teaneck, and Rev Brzezinski moved into town. I was already a teenager, but you know, I certainly got to know Rev Brzezinski as a kid. And then my first job in rabbinics was Rev Brzezinski's assistant for 2 years. I worked with Rev Brzezinski, and it's really to Rev Brzezinski's credit or fault that I stayed in this profession. And so.
Made it look easy. That's what he's saying.
Exactly right. And so I want to thank Rabbi Brzezinski for coming out. Brzezinski, in addition to being the rabbi of the Congregation B'nai Sharon in Teaneck, is also a retired member of the bar, thus COE accredited this morning, and also a prolific blogger and author. So if you haven't seen Rabbi Brzezinski's blog, then, you know, check it out and blame him,
forget
not
that.
Me.
My fourth book is out.
And that's right. I was about to give you a shout out.
I'm just afraid
came out.
You forget.
January 2nd, right?
That's
came
correct.
Out? Is that right?
That's correct.
January 2nd, now available on Amazon, right? The Ethics of Responsibility,
Jewish
I think, is the title.
Jewish Ethics of Responsibility.
I was close. Rabbi Brzezinski's volume 2.
Clearly doesn't own volume 1.
I do own volume 1. Okay. I do own volume 1, right? You could ask them how often I quote it in my drushes.
All right.
But it's lovely to have Rabbi Brzezinski here this morning. Thank you very much for coming out.
Rabbi Feigenbaum,
and as they say in the Berkeley County Beit Midrash, the Chavo Gadol.
Thank you. I want to thank Rabbi Feigenbaum. Indeed, I could say that I'm personally very proud of his accomplishments and his success in the rabbinate, and I wish him only continued hatzlacha, and you as well. So not everyone here is an attorney, but I understand most of the people are. So we want to discuss this morning two separate topics. Beginning the first topic, refugee rights in American and Jewish law. So obviously it's a very complicated, very controversial issue today in America, in Israel as well. Obviously it's a sensitive issue for Jews because of our own history. We've benefited from very liberal policies in America, and we have suffered from very restrictive policies in America. The United States today remains a magnet for immigrants, but the issue is fraught with tension, and above all, with politics at its worst. You take the issue that's on the agenda today, but literally as we speak, the wall along the southern border, the same people are for it and against it, depending on when they're asked and which party's in power. So when Trump praises the effectiveness of the wall, he always mentions Israel. As much as Jews are naturally favorably disposed towards immigrants, especially American Jews, so advocates of a liberal policy should be honest enough to demand the same openness in Israel, which of course doesn't happen for obvious reasons. Israel in the last 2 decades has admitted, legally or not, more than 100,000 migrants, mainly from Africa, Sudan, Eritrea, other African countries, and they filled many menial jobs, but they've also brought social unrest and violent crime and rape and theft, especially to South Tel Aviv, the scene of regular riots and protests by the original residents. Israel a few years ago constructed a wall, really a fence, but you know, very secure fence along its southern border with Egypt that effectively ended this migration. So when Trump refers to a 99.8% effectiveness of a wall, he mentions Israel's wall, which has cut down on the migrants from Africa. And Israel's deported thousands of illegals back to their home country as well. So you have to be careful. What's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. So you can't say only one country in the world should have liberal policies and no other country. Every country has the right to establish and protect its borders and even to protect its national identity, its culture, its values. In an Israeli context, it's fairly clear. It's supposed to be intended to be a Jewish state. In an American context, it's fairly convoluted, the United States being a nation of immigrants. But these are the same tensions today, and they go back about 150 years. there have always been groups that oppose immigration and always been groups that support immigration. And in talking of immigrants, there have always been favorite groups and disfavored groups. In 1880, the population in the United States was 50 million people. Today, it's a little less than 330 million people. The great wave of immigration, 1880 to 1920, saw 20 million immigrants come to America. 2 million Jews, 10%, 4 million Italians. Not well known, but most of the immigrants of the 19th century were actually Germans. Not necessarily German Jews, but German immigrants generally. In the 19th century, there was a disfavored group. Who were they? No, every group's always disfavored. The group disfavored legally were the Chinese. There was a law passed in the 1880s, the Chinese Exclusion Act, to keep them away, and that was the entire discussion you read in the history books of what they called, somewhat politically incorrect today, well, not somewhat, totally, the Yellow Peril. They did not want anyone coming from the Orient. But you had this massive wave of immigration, most of it legal, not all. There are some illegal immigrants as well. I don't doubt that almost everyone here has one family member who came in that period or thereafter illegally. My grandfather, Shalom, had a twin brother. And I was always curious growing up why his twin brother had a different last name than he had. It's because he was excluded when they came in the 1920-21. My grandfather got in. He didn't for some medical reason. And he came in through Mexico but adopted a different identity. So they had two different last names, twin brothers. Eventually he was legalized. So this gravy train ended in 1924 with the Immigration and Nationality Act that implemented for the first time quotas and restrictions. Jews suffered greatly. The number of immigrants, legal immigrants, was capped at 2% of the number of foreign born from that group as it existed in 1890. So Jews were excluded after 1924 by quotas from emigrating to the United States at, of course, the most terrible time. Some Jews were allowed, but most were not. And worse, the quotas went unfulfilled. And that's where you get into the Jew hatred of the 1930s, especially the late 1930s. 1952, the McCarran-Walters Act established limits per country. And further amendments and the big expansion took place in 1965 and thereafter, liberalizing immigration, ending quotas, allowing family sponsors. Most of the legislation from 65 through the early 2000s were spearheaded by, among others, Ted Kennedy, who wanted very open immigration. Thereafter, immigration expanded mainly to Latin America. That's been the source of most immigration to America since, with Asians in second place. We'll return in a few moments to the Refugee Act of 1980. You notice I've been discussing immigrants. Immigrants, by definition, are legal. There's always been illegal immigration as well, and there's been a separate category which is more or less fudged, and that is refugees or asylum seekers that we'll define in a moment. Early immigrants were always vetted. You know, I don't use expressions like undocumented immigrants to refer to illegal aliens. It's like robbing a bank and saying it's an undocumented withdrawal. No, you're a criminal if you come illegally, and there's a price that has to be paid for it. Early immigrants are always vetted. I mean, Ellis Island was famous for that. There are places in New Jersey as well. Some were quarantined. Some were returned to their country of origin. Some were deported over the years in the most famous massive act of deportation unimaginable today, both in scope and in the name that the operation was called, Operation Wetback. 1954, Eisenhower, together with Attorney General Brownell and the head of INS, rounded up and deported 1 million Mexican workers, sent them back to Mexico. Mexico, in fact, it's 1954. Mexico had protested that too many Mexicans were working in the U.S., but Eisenhower, who gave an order, an executive order, to round them up and deport them, and 1 million was sent away within a year, it was assumed that he had the right to do it because it was enshrined in law. So a subdivision of illegals, so to speak, is the refugee. Now, refugee has a defined status in international law. A refugee is someone who flees his native land because of some urgency, but then goes to the adjoining country. So, for example, you've had hundreds of thousands of Syrians flee the civil war in the last few years. As a technical matter, they're refugees only in Jordan, because that's an adjoining country. They made it to Turkey or to Russia. Those are the adjoining countries, or to Iraq. Those are the adjoining countries to Syria. That's why the camps in northern Jordan are called refugee camps. But once they come to Europe or places further, they're no longer considered refugees. They're considered migrants. So the millions in Europe today are not refugees, they're migrants. So too, if a person flees Honduras or Guatemala and tries to come to America, they're not refugees anymore because they've bypassed other countries. The media, when it's careful, uses this terminology as well. A migrant is in essence a less sympathetic figure in the sense that he's no longer in danger. He's bypassed a nearby safe haven and sought out a more distant one, but for personal reasons. There's a third category of alien in this sense. Also, a refugee is not illegal, nor is this category illegal. Those are asylum seekers. Now, asylum seekers have humanitarian rights, but the problem has always been that they show up uncontrolled, haphazardly, and they're a problem for every free country. And the different categories of migrants. There are crisis migrants who are fleeing war, meaning they're affected by it in the sense that anyone's affected by hostilities. And especially the last 10 years, it's become a category in its own right, economic migrants, people fleeing poverty and lack of opportunity to come to a country where they'll feel there's more. This wasn't an official category, economic migrants, until President Obama made them one in 2009. And since then, the U.S. has become the destination of choice for this group. Refugees, technically, must return to their country of origin when the crisis passes. So technically, they're not seeking resettlement. They're seeking humanitarian assistance. That's technically. Practically, it almost never happens. So America has a fourth category in terms of illegals. It's almost impossible to address currently in this environment. The greatest number of illegals in America today are people who simply overstay their visa, meaning they come here legally with a visa, and then the visa expires and they've disappeared into the wind. So today's estimates are between 11 million and 22 million illegal immigrants in America, and the disparity just illustrates how difficult the problem is to resolve. Today, the U.S. accepts more refugees than all of the countries combined, but Europe accepts more migrants simply because they're closer to the zones of stress. Now, obviously, there's an acute political dimension to this as well. Those who favor restrictive policies see immigrants as the bane of civil society, whether through the transfer of wealth to these aliens, through welfare, social services, education, healthcare, etc., the problems of illegal voting, and they see it also as well as a natural addition to the Democrat Party as the party of free stuff, which many immigrants today want. Immigrants a century and a half ago, that wasn't an option. Those who favor more liberal policies like all of the above, they resent America's original whiteness and its culture. In the best sense, they see this welcoming as part of the American spirit and ethos. And I say again, we benefited from it. I look around the room today, I can't see even one of you having ancestors that came here on the Mayflower. So, in fact, we're all the immigrants or the children of immigrants. And some, and this is more to the right of the political spectrum, enjoy the cheap labor that illegal immigration brings as well. Well, let's just look for a moment at the Refugee Act of 1980. It's in the English handout, letter A. 1980 is the last time you really had a legislation that was... Yeah, it's the gold right there. There are two different sheets, so you need the second one after that. Refugee Act of 1980 is the last time Congress addressed this comprehensively. Congress declares, Section 101A, it is the historic policy of the United States to respond to the urgent needs of persons subject to persecution in their homelands, including, where appropriate, humanitarian assistance for their care and maintenance in asylum areas, efforts to promote opportunities for resettlement or voluntary repatriation, aid for necessary transportation processing, admission to this country of refugees with special humanitarian concern to the United States, and transitional assistance to refugees in the United States. Note the phrases, transitional assistance, because it's meant to be temporary. Who's a refugee? That's entitled to Section 20142. The term refugee means, A, any person who is outside any country of such person's nationality, or in the case of a person having no nationality, is outside no nationality, meaning you fled a war zone and your country was then conquered by another country, so that you no longer have a nationality. Is outside any country which such person last habitually resided, or is unable or unwilling to return to, and is unable or unwilling to avail himself or herself of the protection of that country because of persecution or a well-founded fear of persecution on account of race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion, or whatever special circumstances the president, after appropriate consultation, may specify. Now, that clause itself will play a role in the big controversies going on today. But you'll note in Section 2007 at the bottom, there's a limit of 50,000 per year, unless the president determines that admission in excess is justified by humanitarian concerns or is otherwise in the national interest. And you see in B, there's an asylum procedure that is regulated by the Attorney General. Note in Title II, both in Section 201 and 207, and really complete throughout the Refugee Act of 1980, great credit and great discretion is given to the President of the United States, meaning he is allowed to decree or not to decree based on his own concerns. Now, if you look at letter C, C and D really became the two issues that the courts have had to resolve in the last 2 years. In 8 U.S. Code, Section 1182.14f, suspension of entry or imposition of restrictions by president, whenever the president finds that the entry of any aliens or of any class of aliens into the United States would be detrimental to the interests of the United States, he may, by proclamation for such period as he shall deem necessary, suspend the entry of all aliens or any class of aliens as immigrants or non-immigrants, or impose on the entry of aliens any restrictions he may deem to be appropriate. This was the source of what became known colloquially as the Muslim ban. Now, obviously, again, I don't want to get too much involved in the politics, not too much, but the fact is, it never was a Muslim ban because the most populous Muslim countries in the world were not part of the ban. If you take the population of the six countries plus North Korea, forget them for a moment, but the six countries that are predominantly Muslim, it's less than 10% of the number of Muslims in the world. The most populous Muslim country in the world today is? Indonesia. Very good. Second?
Pakistan.
India. India is more Muslims than Pakistan even. So in fact, neither the Muslims from Indonesia or India or Pakistan, for that matter, are part of this ban. So it was, of course, engendered by President Trump's, if you notice, his tendency to speak off the cuff, occasionally a very harsh way, if you follow the news. The way it was presented, of course, was a way that offended many people. And yet, you see, in section 1182, there's no restriction on the president. He finds it's detrimental to the interests of the United States. So it can apply to the Muslims, and it can apply to, as well, to migrants coming from Latin America. But the other side argued a clause in section 1152, except as specifically provided, no person shall receive any preference or priority or be discriminated against in the issuance of an immigrant visa because of the person's race, sex, nationality, place of birth, or place of residence. This became the clause in the United States Code that the Ninth Circuit jumped on, the Ninth Circuit being the source of many, many interesting rulings, most having nothing to do with the Constitution or American law in the last decade or so. But this is the case. These are the two clauses that became the subject of the machlokes on both sides that was resolved just a half year ago in, if you flip the page, in the case of Trump versus Hawaii. And the court ruled 5-4 that if you take those two clauses, they are addressing two different things. So the court ruled, there's an opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, the president, the 1182 gives the president broad discretion to suspend the entry of aliens into the United States. The president lawfully exercised that discretion based on his findings that entry of the covered aliens would be detrimental to the national interest. Period. There's no, I don't want to get into the word standing in a legal sense, but there's no argument that the president's discretion has to be limited unless there's an argument that it's not really detrimental and there's another clause, but that's not in the statute. The statute gives the president broad discretion. The machlokas between 1182 and 1152, so the court, forgive the language, had a good svara. And they said, in the third paragraph, we reject plaintiff's interpretation. 1182 and 1152 dealt with two different things. If you skip down in the middle, sections 1182 and 1152 thus operate in different spheres. 1182 defines the universe of aliens who are admissible into the United States and therefore eligible to receive a visa. It sets the boundaries of admissibility, as opposed to 1152, which deals with visa issuance alone. Meaning, go back to the text, 1152, that speaks about no person shall receive any preference or be discriminated against because of all those reasons, race, sex, nationality, place of birth, place of residence, that's referring to a person who applies for a visa, that the consular officer or any other official cannot deny a visa to someone who's applied for it based on any of these considerations. But that is superseded by 1182, which defines the class of people to whom visas or admission to America are even a possibility. Back to the text of Trump versus Hawaii. Had Congress intended in 1152 to constrain the president's power to determine who may enter the country, it could easily have chosen language directed to that end. Common sense and historical practice confirm as much. 1152 has never been treated as a constraint on the criteria for admissibility in 1182. So the Eisenhower case we mentioned, but you'll note, presidents have repeatedly exercised their authority to suspend entry on the basis of nationality. And what you have now is the court mentioned two specific cases. One, President Reagan suspended the entry of as immigrants by all Cuban nationals, period, end of discussion. And earlier, Carter had revoked visas to all Iranian nationals after Iran occupied the American embassy in 1979 in Tehran. Carter banned the entry of all Iranians. Reagan banned the entry of all Cubans. For that matter, for many years there's been a ban on entry on North Koreans and other countries, and that's what Trump did to residents of these countries. That's a little more involved because, in fact, the issue became, or the issue was presented, as not really on a ban from Muslims from these particular countries, but it was these particular countries did not have vetting procedures in place. They did not comply with American law requirements to ensure that the people trying to enter were really fully vetted and did not pose a threat. It's a mystery, in fact, why it was a 5-4 vote, such as things go, except for the politicization of the judiciary. As we know, it's not resolved. The fight, in essence, is the same fight already for 150 years over which groups can enter, in what number, and what to do with those here illegally. Now, there's a compelling argument for the legalization of the DACA recipients, you know, the Dreamers. The Dreamers are children of illegal immigrants who came to America with them. So I understand morality, and I understand the sensitivity of the area, and you can't blame them. You can't send a kid back to Ecuador when basically he was raised in America, doesn't speak Spanish, and this is his culture, this is his life. I understand that completely. And, you know, so many things in life is marketing, right? The Dreamers sounds very good. You know, stifle someone's dream? That can't be. I personally, to be accurate, call them chips. Children of illegal immigrant parents. You call them chips, it doesn't sound as catchy anymore, and, you know, there's no compelling issue. But you can't blame the children. And it just makes sense to find some way to resolve their status. On the other hand, also compelling argument, there are many thousands of people, tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands across the world who have heeded the rules, and are awaiting visas. So to reward criminal behavior is to incentivize it. And it's grossly unfair to the law-abiding who try to play by the rules. On the third hand, America will never tolerate mass roundups and deportations. On the fourth hand, there are roughly 3 billion people in the world who live under some sort of duress, whether political or social or economic. They can't all come to America. On the fifth hand, there's much merit in the argument that until the border is secure, it makes no sense to legalize anyone because it only encourages more illegals to come. So now you have 5 hands, and most of us have only 2. There's a stark conflict, therefore, between the heart and the mind, between the ideal and the reality, between American values and the social well-being of the country. That is why it is so vexing and difficult to resolve and the object of so much politics. No, what does the Torah have to say about all this? How does the Torah look at refugees? It's in a general sense. We'll get back to it in a few moments. The Torah is talking about the land of Israel. A non-Jew has no inherent right to live in the land of Israel. But we'll begin with something else. I quote the number one, the Netziv, in his Hakdama to Sefer Bereishis. And the Netziv writes that the Sefer Bereishis is called Sefer HaYashar, the Book of the Upright, because the Avos were known to be Yesharim, upright, straight, people of integrity. Meaning what? So if you look right in the middle, Od Ho Yesharim, Hainu, She Hisnagu Im Umo Sa'ola Mafilu Ovde Lilim Michuarim, that they dealt with even ugly idolaters. Mikol makom hayu imam bi'ahava. They dealt with them with love. V'choshu l'tavasam kasher hikiyam abriya. And they always looked out for their well-being, for their welfare, because that's the survival of the planet. K'moshanu roam kama hishtateach Avram avinu spalom al Sodom. Like Avram went to bat for the people of Sodom. So there is always a very strong Jewish interest. And the ethic of Torah is characterized by concern not just for Jews, but for all people as well. And of course, you see in the Rabbeinu Yonah in Avos, in the Mishnah, the third parak, Hevi Mispal B'Shlomo Shel Malchus, we should always pray for the well-being of the government. So you see at the bottom, The Rabbeinu Yonah writes, at the beginning, Ratzal Lomar, Sheyesh Lodim L'spal Shalom Kol Ha'olam U'L'Tzar Tzar Shal Acherim. A person is supposed to daven for, not just for his own government, but for peace for the world, and to feel pain, be grieved by the pain of other people as well. So to be cold-hearted and to turn people away in their situation of stress, so that is not the Jewish or very moral approach. And really, the Meshech Chochma, in number four, the top left, in his commentary on the Akedah, speaks of Yerushalayim. Shalem, the city of completeness, of wholeness, Shumara Shekola Mina Enoshihu Adam Echad. All the human species is like one person. V'chol Echad Uevrim Evreya Adam Agadol. And everyone is like a limb of Adam Arishon. V'chol Echad Nitzrach Chavero. So we're all part of one body. Right arm, left foot. We all need each other. Mushba Mashpia Zemizeh. We all influence and are influenced by each other. V'kulam Ke'echad Nosim Kiyam Min Enoshi V'nitzchi Yoso. And all of us bear responsibility for the survival and eternity of the human race. He's not talking about Jews. He's talking about everybody, humanity as a whole. And there's no doubt, we see from the way Jews live in America, sometimes to a fault, our concern for the broader society, especially on the part of many Jews, sometimes exceeds their concern for the Jewish people. Meaning they're universalists, they're globalists, more concerned with society at large than the Jewish people. But nonetheless, that is rooted in a core Jewish value as well. Of course, you know, we'll see Ani Erech HaKodmi, we have to take care of our own first, but nonetheless, you can't just say, I'll take care of my own Aniim, and the rest of the world, you know, they'll worry about themselves. On the other hand, you need common sense in every area of life. So you look at the Sifra in Bechukos, it's number 3, right on the top, speaking about the brachos before the tochacha, emein shvenasati shalom ba'aretz, emein shalom ein klum. You could have prosperity. You could have literal peace, but if there's no peace itself, if you render your society insecure, fearful, subject to terror, dislocation, etc., then all the wealth that you have is not going to matter. Emein shalom, ein klum. In times of danger, you see in number 7, the king on the left, the Rambam and Hilchas Malach and Perek Ha'alacha, Aleph and Gimel, among the things the king is allowed to do, the king has an absolute right of eminent domain of seizing anyone's property, anytime, but certainly in a time of war, because he's responsible for the security and well-being of his people. So therefore, individual rights are going to be diminished or reduced in order to bring about the protection of the general society. Now, you see in number 5, an interesting case, the bottom right, a tshuva of the Rashba, Chelek Dalad, Siman Kuf Peches. And again, what all this is talking about is you have the general right, but those general rights are going to be limited if there are other reasons. So Rashba was asked this question, Im Rasho Matzibur Lasos Takonos Vaskamos Ugedarim Beineyem V'leknos V'leanosh Al Haskemoseyem Shlomi Dinatori Imlo. Can a defined group of people make their own laws in a community, in a neighborhood, in a profession, in an occupation? Can they make restrictive laws that are not part of the Torah system simply for their own well-being? And the Rashba says, Dova Baruhu, it's clear. Shatsibu Rasham Ligdor Lusakain Takonos Vilasos Haskamos Kafima Shayira Beineyam Varehu Kayom Kedin Torah. That Tzibur can make any ordinances at once, even though the Torah does not speak about them, and they have the force of Din Torah, if they deem it necessary to preserve societal order, economic order, for example. So you see, going down, the Tabachim, the Tzabaim, the Saponim, you have a group of butchers, of painters, any profession, any guild, they can make their own rules, even restricting others from conducting their business in their particular area. Or we'll see in a moment, this became the premise of restricting entry to Jewish communities, either permanently or temporarily, in order to preserve some sort of social harmony. The only limitation the Rashba placed on this right is you have to have some Talmud Chacham involved to say that it's not going to otherwise harm the society. But if the Talmud Chacham is involved, they can do it as the force of Jewish law. Yes, sir?
Doesn't he also seem to require unanimous consent?
Amongst the people doing it.
Yeah, he says, twice.
Right. In that group. Meaning, if the group of Tabachim get together and they make a restrictive law for their guild, that's enough. You don't need the others in society to agree. It's that defined group. You can get five plumbers to agree to keep another plumber out. Yeah.
What you're really talking about is they just want to raise prices.
Not necessarily. Yeah. Right. Well, you could say quality control. We could be nice about it.
That's what the guild would say.
Right.
You know, all this licensing. I mean, many of us are licensed. Part of the licensing is you want to.
Always. Right.
It's good for the people who are regulated.
That's correct.
So you know, this is not necessarily good for the community. It's good for the guild.
Yes, you're correct. Well, that's only one aspect of it. It also will see metamorphosed into a general rule, keeping people out of the neighborhood, the province, the country. If they can't pay a poll tax, a head tax, they'll deplete community resources. But we'll see that in a few moments. Your point, though, is well taken, because it's an issue that's heavily litigated today in America. You have these places, actually every state has these crazy laws. In a place in the South, I think the Alliance for Justice sues on their behalf, or Defending Justice, whatever the name is, a hairdresser, like 18 months, costs tens of thousands of dollars to get a license to braid hair, all right, would be a cosmetologist, and the be a funeral director. And the only point is to restrict entry into that particular guild. So you're right, it's a problem, but aside from the guild issues, you have these broader issues as well. Now, I want to go back to one thing that I said about entry into the land of Israel. If you look at the Rambam in number 6, Hilchas Avodah Zarah, Perek Yud Halacha Hey and Vav, so Mefanesin Ani Avdei Kochav in Yisrael Mevedarkei Shalom, the ways of peace demand that we sustain non-Jewish poor like Jewish poor and all the other. But Avo Bezman Sheyad Yisrael Tekif Aleihem Asu Lano Laniach Avdei Kochav in Beinenu Afil Yoshev Veshivas Arai O Over Mimakom Lemakom Bischora Lo Yava Bartzenu Ela Ad Shekabel Olav Sheva Mitzvos Shenisnavu B'nei Noach. Very interesting clause in the Rambam. Not only can't you allow non-Jews to reside in the land of Israel unless they accept the Shem's B'nei Noach, you can't even let a tourist or a merchant enter the land unless they commit to observe these seven basic Noahide laws. The Ravid at the end says, Zos lo motzono lo shamanu me'olam. He doesn't know what the Rambam based it on, but it seems clear that what the Rambam is saying, that Eretz Yisrael as a polity, as a geographic entity, is more than land. It represents a certain value system, a set of ideas. And any group that's going to come in and impair the dissemination of those ideas or undermine the security of the polity has no right to be there. All right, what about the refugee issue? So it's interesting to note that not only have Jews experienced that in every country of the world vis-a-vis non-Jewish countries that wanted to let us in, but it has been in our history something that the Jewish community itself has had to reckon with, and like many things in Jewish life, it's subject to a big machlokas. Already in the 11th century, the phrase that was used to as the hook on which to discuss these issues was zchut ha'yishuv, the right of residence. And that was hotly debated. Is there such a thing as the right of residence? To wit, does any person in the world have the right to say, I want to live here, I want to live there? Or is a country, a community, allowed to say, no, we don't want you, you can't enter, and you can't live here either? Well, of course, we want each country to retain its national character. Chazal, the Torah, spoke of Shivim Umos, 70 nations. We're not globalists. On the contrary, we think it's best that there be nations in the world representing different facets of humanity, all at some point acknowledging the reality of God's morality. But a nation, of course, is not a nation unless it has borders that it controls. It's the fundamental aspect of sovereignty. So I mentioned before, Israel's struggling with this. No country does it well. Remember, Menachem Begin, Zichron Avraham, admitted 700 Vietnamese refugees in the late 1970s, the boat people. But he admitted 700, not 7,000, and not 70,000, or 700,000. Rashi says at the end of the Torah, Barzel unechoshes min alecha, uchayamecha davecha. Barzel unechoshes min alecha. That your locks will be made of iron and brass. So Rashi says there, it's not on your text here, Shehoyu Giborim Yoshim Ba'ari Asfar, that Israel is supposed to put Giborim, warriors, in the border cities, V'noalim Osa, and to lock them. So Yuchlu Ha'ayvim Likonezba, so the enemy cannot enter. It's Ke'ilu Hisgurab Min Alimu Brichim Shel Barzel Nechoshes. It's as if it's locked with iron, with steel. Meaning what? In Moshe's vision of the ideal Jewish state, it requires secure borders. That we control who enters, and we're able to keep out people that we don't want to enter as well. Nu, is there such a thing as Zchut HaYishuv? Big machlokas. Look at number 9, the tour on the left side of the page. It's in Hilchos Nizkei Shcheinim, Siman Kuf Nun Vav. Tour says his father, the Rosh, was asked this question. Yehudi sherotze lolechas l'kfar l'adur shom l'arviach. A Jew wants to go live in a village in order to make his parnasa there. Vamal anshei oso kfar, the people of that village said, kom mifsadet l'chiyuseinu, you're going to ruin our livelihood. V'rotze marchiko me'al gvulom. And we want to keep them away from our borders. The Rosh answered, Ein yecholim limon'o. You're not allowed to keep them away. De'lo komar tamuda el odom hador bi'ir hazos uba lahamid rechaim uchanus makom acher en ashach b'mash elohem. The Gemara only speaks about a case where a person is living in a certain city and he wants to compete directly adjacent to someone in the same field. He's not paying taxes. The people of that city can protest, can prevent him. This comes up in our context as well. You know, America is a free, open, and competitive society, but I understand the sensitivity, all right? Let's say you have a sofa in town. He establishes a store, he pays rent, he's part of the town. And you have occasionally these itinerant sofrim come, and they want to sell tefillin, mezuzahs, they come for the day. All right, want to check mezuzahs or tefillin, they come for the day. On the one hand, competition is good. On the other hand, the guy pays rent, he's part of the community. So how do you let someone else in just for the day? It's going to undermine his business. I see the problem. But here the Rosh said, Dover pashadu she'odom yachol lagur b'chol makom she'yirtze. Person allowed to live wherever he wants to live. Did people acquire their rights by force to keep people out? No. The Rush is clear. You can't prevent people from living wherever they want to live. The big bar plukt of the Rosh was the Maharik, Rabbi Yosef Kolon. And it's in Tshuva Kuf Tzadi Aleph, but it's quoted here in the Beis Yosef in Kuf Nun Vav in 10. And as strong as the Rosh was in being permissive, the Maharik is equally strong in being restrictive. And he says, quotes the Maharik, the second paragraph, Herech me'o b'dinim elu. And he says, what the Rosh wrote, you can live wherever you want. Pshita, sherotz alomar, she'em b'nei yechol ma'kevel av alpi beistin. That you can't do it through beistin. Avalim tigbar yad b'nei u'ir l'zgar dosh b'pei. But if the people of the city is strong enough to lock the doors, lock the gates, hein al yidei asar, hein al yidei shum monea, whether they use the government to do it or they do it themselves, pshito sharashus biyadam, they have the right to do it. Vol yachlok al ze ki ima ikesh v'psaltol asher lo yodav lo yavin vol gia lo ra ad kan l'shono. The Maharik says the only person who would object to this is a stubborn fool who doesn't know anything, doesn't understand anything, and has not reached the level of Hora. Turns out, in the Tshuva, Maharik says, he lists the Rif, the Rambam, or the Maharit, Bishu Mitrani, who agree with him, and he says, even the Rosh would agree with him, based on the Gemara in Baba Basra, that Pshitali, Bar Masa Achriti Matzi Ma'akev, if you are a resident with a profession in one city, you can prevent someone from another city who's not a taxpayer from coming in and doing the work there. Now, this machlokes of the Rosh and the Maharik is reverberated through the centuries. If you look to number 14 first, it's the Ramah in Shulchan Aruch, right here, Alatar, and he mentions both cases. Mentions the Rosh right in the middle of the bold. Do you chaladim ladur b'chol makom shiritzev? Ain't a rishonim kano ir b'chaska? No one acquired the city by force; that they're the dictators. That's the Rosh. V'yesh cholkim v'omrim dichol mchos b'yadam. Others say no, that you're allowed to prevent them from coming. Bifrat bizman azesh adarm tachas umas. Certainly now we're living under the yoke of the non-Jews. V'yesh lachushim yitausfu hadiyurin. If too many Jews come, it's going to offend or aggravate the authorities. L'chein habala dur hevi karodev. If you have this influx, even of one Jew, but of massive Jews, they're rodfim, because undermining the stability of the existing community. Ulekuli alma im bnei oir yechom lizgar adels v'ligram im moshlam sheyimchu bebam lagur o aydemone acher harshus biyadam. And here's verbatim the Maharik. Everyone holds, the Ramah says, if the entire city decides to close the gates and they make an arrangement with the rulers to bar entry from anyone, or they use some other type of impediment, harashus biyadam, they have the right to do that. V'yesh mekomo shenogim lasus cherem cheskas yishuv. The places where the official body, the Jewish community, declared a cherem. No one else can come in. They don't want any other people to come in. V'oz yecholim locho v'lo midinos. They can do it. It's not me'ikr din Torah, but they have the right to do it as well. V'yecholim ligzo shal yisor v'litainim abam ladur b'lo reshusam. The right to say that nobody can do business unless they first get a permit. This, of course, was also noted by the Ramah in the Darkei Moshe. So we're talking here in the first instance about economic migrants, but in the second instance about refugees as well. So refugees can't be turned away if there's danger, but residents also can't turn them away if they can make enough money to keep themselves alive until the danger is over. But if you can't pay taxes, if you can't contribute, they have the right to keep you away. And this is number 12, and again, Kuf Nun Vav Sifhei in the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. V'rabim ha'omrim dafilu hachi ein l'rishu likanis l'mavoy she'esham b'nei u'manaso. Baal Umnas can prevent his compatriot from entering as well. Avo mavoy acher ein yachal nuchas bo ho v'no sein mas. They can demand that before the entry, they have to pay some money to get in, so it doesn't dilute their standing. What's interesting as well is you had a refugee who's in danger, then you can't keep him away. But what about when the danger passes? Remember I said earlier that technically a refugee is a temporary resident, and when the crisis passes, he has to go back? Nu, v'chein hoya. This is from the Pinchas Kilas Pozen, 1636. They dealt with this issue, and all these records are extant. There was a Jew named Reb Tevela who came. He fled hostilities in his own place. He went to live in Poland. They said he has no cheskat ironut. He has no permanent permission to reside there. He came machamas rasha mechama. He came because of the war. He stayed 2 years. Aval achshav nishketa hamilchama b'medina. But now the war ended, and that community has gone back to its prior state. They said to him after Pesach, "Ein lo shum zchut chelik v'nachlapo." You have no right to remain here any longer. You have to go back to your land. Now, if you look just for a moment at 15, you see he quotes the Mabit who disagree with the Maharik and the Bach, and he concludes, Lefinis Daiti, according to the Bach, Nirash Akolafi Amalchus, Uminaga Medina, Uchuvus Maharik, Einot Sodekas, Elab Amalchus, Shehoya Yoshev Sham, Uloosein Hayomim. He limits the Maharik to his particular time and place, and the political circumstances, he was Italian, the political circumstances in which he wrote, but it has no, the Bach says, universal applicability. Nonetheless, Hakol fi Malchus uminaga medina. It's all open to what the Malchus demands. Look, it's not simple, neither the American law nor the Jewish law for that matter, and as I said before, the interplay of the emotions on both sides renders it almost an insoluble issue. Obviously, there's sakanas nefashos, there's pikuach nefesh, there's rachmonas that we have for people. On the other hand, there's issues of societal cohesion and stability and security, economic viability that affects everyone. The bottom line is, as the Rav Kook wrote in Musar Avicha, in number 16, we have to find the honorable way in everything. Then the light of the world is revealed. And then the shame of all nations will be, or the shame of God's nation will be removed from the earth. The light of Mashiach, when it radiates in our hearts, it teaches us to respect all people. Here's a pasuk from the Haftarah we recite on the Achon Shel Pesach. V'yamayimahu shoresh yishai, asher melenei samim, a love goyim yidroshu, v'yitam menuchato kavod. The time will come, there'll be a greater understanding of the universal value of kavod abrios, the ultimate universal value of recognition of the Malchus Hashem, which implies that we also recognize that we're all children of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we're beholden to his morality and to his value system, and therefore we have to help all others. We're not quite there, and hence all the disruption today, all the unrest. But nonetheless, when we get there, a lot of these problems will be resolved as well, and we can only hope for that. The bottom line is, American law is really clear. It's in disarray because of the politics. Jewish law is a little less clear. There are rights that people have to keep out others. Those rights, though, will themselves be restricted by circumstances, and of course by the Jewish heart, but also the recognition that a society is designed to enhance, not to undermine, the stability of its residents. Ad kan.